Good evening. Thank you, everyone. We're at 6 p.m. If everyone could take their seats. I would like to introduce Commissioner Armando Quintero to provide our welcome.
Good evening. I'm glad you're all here. There's eight commissioners, and tonight I represent the other seven, and we're really glad you're here. The public process involved in putting together the draft guidelines has been really critical, so we're really looking forward to your comments, and thank you for taking your... Oh, is that better? I'm saying thank you for being here this evening. And the public comment and participation with the commission has been critical in helping us shape the draft guidelines for the Water Storage Improvement Program, and we're very glad you're here. Are there any elected officials here this evening? No? Okay. Thanks for being here.
And Rachel Belanti is up to give you some additional welcome from the Water Commission.
Hi, Rachel Belanti. I am the Assistant Executive Officer for the Commission, and my comments will follow very much in the vein of Armando's. We're really excited to be here in Lafayette. This is our second meeting in this area. We had a public meeting at the beginning of our public meeting series in Pleasant Hill in April. This is our third in a series of public meetings that we've had this summer, so we've been doing really extensive outreach regarding our regulations. And this meeting is particularly exciting because it is the first meeting where we have a staff draft of our regulations. So as Armando said, we're really looking forward to getting your feedback and your comments now and as we continue our public comment process. I would quickly just like to thank the staff who put this meeting together and have done quite a bit of work. Staff from the California Water Commission, DWR, staff from the State Board and Department of Fish and Wildlife are here, and also the Center for Collaborative Policy and Edelman. So thank you, and I'm going to introduce, am I going to introduce Denny or am I going to go back to you?
Before we start with the presentations, I just want to make sure everyone knows about the emergency exits, which are over here. We do have water in the corner. We are being webcast for those that are unable to attend in person, so that would be why we ask that everyone speak into the microphones, and we do have some video. Bathrooms are out and to the right, and as you came in, you probably got a collection of paperwork, and the most important would be the draft regulations that Rachel mentioned. That's the big packet. Please feel free to take that back and review. As you review it, you may have additional comments or questions than what you have tonight. That's where this handy card that you got with links comes in. You can access a number of different links on this, and on the back it has a place for comments. So you don't have to have all your questions tonight or comments tonight, you have an opportunity through the links. You also have a copy of our PowerPoint presentations, which is the other large packet, in addition to a lot of other different and useful brochures, public benefits, information on the Water Commission and the Water Storage Improvement Program, the Water Storage Improvement Program timeline. This will be in the presentation, but so that you have a larger version to look at, that is available for you. And then we have the agenda for this evening. So as you can see, we've gone through our opening remarks. We've done our introductions for those of the staff that are here. We will start with a presentation from Jenny Marr on Water Storage Investment Program, just an overview of the draft regulations. And then we will have about 20 minutes for questions and comments with respect to that presentation. We ask that you use that time for questions specific to Jenny's presentation, and if you have additional comments, we do have time at the end of today. We have a significant amount of time for those questions and comments then. At 6:45, we'll do a presentation on the ecosystem and water quality priorities and relative environmental values, and that presentation will be by Scott Cantrell from Department of Fish and Wildlife and Gail Link from California State Water Resources Control Board. Again, we will have about 20 minutes, 15, 20 minutes for questions specific to those presentations, so clarifying questions or comments related to that. And then we will open it up to general comments for the room. We do have a microphone in the center of the room. That would be where we ask that you line up. If you have any physical limitations or disabilities that makes it difficult for you to stand in line, just raise your hand and I will bring the mic over to you in accordance with the line. But that will help make sure that we get everybody a microphone for comments. So with that, I am going to turn over the microphone to Jenny Marr, who will give you the first presentation.
Good afternoon, everyone. Hopefully you can hear me okay. I'd like to welcome everyone and welcome folks who are viewing over our live webcast. They didn't mention it was live, so we won't be able to edit out the bloopers later. So again, my name is Jenny Marr. I am a supervising engineer for the commission and the project manager for the Water Storage Investment Program. I'm going to try to keep this presentation brief. We did, this is our third series of our public meetings where we covered a lot of introductory information previously. So I'm going to breeze through that pretty quickly because we really want to get to your comments. You know, the reason that we're here and that you're here is so we can hear your feedback. And so I'm going to try to do this as quickly as possible, recognizing that this isn't the last time you'll see us. We're still early in the process. We're still doing public outreach. For any of you that are project proponents, we'll be doing technical workshops later on in the process. So this is just some very introductory type information, really focusing on these four questions. What's the Water Storage Investment Program about? What's the schedule? What are the regulations? What's in the regulations? And what is this formal rulemaking process that the Commission's about to embark on? So the real reason that everyone's here is because Proposition 1 passed in November of 2014, and it appropriated to the Commission $2.7 billion to fund the public benefits of water storage projects. And these water storage projects must improve the operation of the state water system, be cost-effective, provide a net improvement in ecosystem and water quality conditions. So what are these water storage projects? Here's the list that is provided in statute. Each of these project types are defined in a little bit more detail in the regulations under the definition section. So if you wanted some more specific information on the types of projects and what might fit within each of those, it's in the regulation. But as you can see, it's a broad group of project types, from small to large throughout the state, as big as the CalFed surface storage projects to as small as local groundwater. So we're trying to develop this program with some flexibility and scalability to fit all these types of projects. Yes, please. So public benefits of water storage projects. What are the public benefits? Proposition 1 defines these public benefits as ecosystem improvements, water quality improvements, flood control, emergency response, and recreation. Again, these public benefits are defined in the regulation that you have in front of you. And we want to kind of stress that these are the fundable public benefits for Prop 1 money. They're not the only types of benefits that water storage can provide. So the Water Commission and Prop 1 funding is a cost-share partner. There's other beneficiaries, there's other cost-share partners that are funding benefits such as water supply or hydropower or other benefits of storage. So with those cost-share partners, there's cost-share rules that are set forth in Proposition 1. And those rules are the Commission can fund up to 50% of a total project cost. And of that 50%, which is going to be based on the amount of public benefit provided by the project, but another rule within Proposition 1 is that the public benefits funded by the Commission must be 50% ecosystem improvements. So to even be eligible, your project has to provide ecosystem improvements. And that's going to set the bar for how much, up to 50%, the Commission can cost share. An important requirement of Proposition 1 is that any project funded by the Commission has to provide measurable improvements to the Delta ecosystem or tributaries to the Delta. So that's really important. You know, this is one of the key eligibility requirements of this program, that not only have you seen the list of eligible project types, but if you are an eligible project and an eligible applicant, you still have to make sure that your project hits this mark and provides measurable improvements to the Delta or tributaries to the Delta. And there's definitions of all of that in your regulations package. So then our program. The statute requires the commission to select projects through a competitive public process. So we interpreted competitive to mean we see all the projects at once. So right now there's only one planned solicitation, but that could change in the future depending on the amount of eligible projects and the amount requested. And this public process is really important because we want to be visible. And we've done a lot of public meetings in this first year, and we're going to continue that process. And every commission meeting is public. And it's noticed 10 days in advance, so you know what the commission is going to be talking about. And any decision that the commission makes on any project or any review of any project will be done in a public forum. So we've named our competitive process the Water Storage Investment Program. So you'll see Water Storage Investment Program, or WSIP for short, and some people have shortened it even more to WISP. So a key part of this program is that the commission is going to adopt these regulations by December 15th, 2016. So you'll notice there's still a lot of time in this process here. You're seeing our first staff draft. And the commission actually saw the first staff draft just a couple weeks ago, so you're not too far behind what they're working on. This is also the same version of the regulations that the commission will be reviewing and commenting on at their October meeting on the 21st. So the statute required these regulations to include the quantification of public benefits and the management of public benefits. We've also added into the regulation program guidelines, and the guidelines just lay out the requirements for the applications, how we're going to run the process, and so we've added in a lot of information and details on how we're going to review and solicit project applications. Oh, another key date or key item associated with the December 15th, 2016 date. It's not only the day that the commission will need to adopt the regulations, it's also the first day that the commission can spend any money on projects. So a lot of folks have asked, why aren't you funding projects now? We're in a drought. We really need this money. We've got projects ready to go. Well, the statute didn't release any of this money for projects until December 15, 2016. So really, although we're in the throes of a four-year drought, this money was not for the immediate needs. It's for planning for the future, for the next drought, and really allowing project proponents and the commission to be strategic about future needs in the state. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this slide, and in your handout is a blown-up version of this schedule, because I know it is hard to see, but there's a lot of important information on it. So we've got 3 years outlined here, 2015 being almost over, shockingly. We've done a lot of work to develop the draft regulations. And so you'll see in there our public meeting series. We've had stakeholder advisory committee meetings that have been meeting monthly. And so we've really tried to develop the content and formulate this program with public input and stakeholder input. So the draft that you see in front of you has been worked on over several months. So at the end of this year, you'll see the star for our milestone that the commission is going to approve this version or a future version of the draft regulations to start what's called a formal rulemaking process. And I'll provide a little bit more detail of that in a second. But what the commission is approving is just to start the process. So this is not the last chance to comment on the draft regulations. This is just the first opportunity to look at it in what we've been calling an informal comment period. But once the commission adopts this or approves this version of the regulations, we'll submit a package to the Office of Administrative Law. And once that package is published in the California Regulatory Notice Register, that's when we start this formal rulemaking process. And that could be all of 2016. So this formal rulemaking process follows the Administrative Procedures Act. And in that, it specifies that you've got up to a year to get through the formal rulemaking process. Once we start this process, the first thing that happens is there's a 45-day public comment period. And any comments received during that period are considered formal comments, and the commission and commission staff have to respond to every single one of those comments. Also, during that 45-day public comment period, we'll be doing public hearings where we'll be taking verbal comments on the regulation. And so at a minimum, this formal rulemaking process that could take up all of 2016, at a minimum, it would be that 45-day public comment period. But any time a change is made to the regulation, we have to open up a new comment period, and that could be anywhere from 15 to another 45 days. So this formal rulemaking process, as I said, it follows the Administrative Procedure Act, and the purpose of that is to provide meaningful opportunity for public input. So we really want to solicit public input on these regulations, and it also provides a hopefully sufficient notice to the regulated community. So those folks that are actually going to be doing applications and that are project proponents. So once we finish this 2016 formal rulemaking process, the regulations would be reviewed and approved by the Office of Administrative Law, and then the commission would adopt the regulation, of course, by that date of December 15, 2016. So getting into the project solicitation, and we've got that, you know, penciled in for 2017. At previous public meetings, if you attended any of those, we talked about potentially shifting up the schedule if we were able to make it through the formal OAL process quickly. But some of the feedback we've received from project proponents is that's going to be too hard for us. You know, give us the date, stick to the date, and then you know, if you make it through the process quicker, give us more time to do the application and finish plan formulation. So at this point in time, we're looking at this as a pretty close schedule to what the actual solicitation periods are going to be. So in early 2017, we're going to initiate our first step in a two-step application process, which will be what we're calling a pre-application. And a pre-application is just early notice to the commission about the projects that are out there, what who the applicant is, what the potential project benefits are, and some very preliminary information on the project. You know, just a couple pages of this is who I am, this is my project, this is what we're hoping to provide. And the commission is going to look at those pre-applications and provide some early feedback. So if they see any fatal flaws or potential issues, or notice that an application comes in and doesn't check the box for measurable improvements to the Delta or Delta TRIBs, then there'll be a feedback in what we're calling the pre-application assessment, so project proponents and applicants can go back before they spend the time to do their full application and fix any issues that there might be. There's a couple reasons why we're doing this pre-application process. It's early information to the commission, so they get a sense of what projects may be applying. It allows applicants to see other potential project proponents for potentially teaming up or integrating projects or prioritizing projects in a region. And it also allows the applicants to hear about any issues or fatal flaws that their project might have. So once the pre-application period is over, we'll start the full application development period. And that we're anticipating right now to be about 6 months, from the start of the solicitation period to the deadline for full applications. And so you see 2017 is mostly that project solicitation phase where it's really on the project proponent to do their work. And it's the following year that's not on here, 2018, that's really the year that will be the technical review, the independent peer review, the commission's decision time. So we've got, you know, a lot of process ahead of us, but we're going to streamline it as much as possible and provide as much technical assistance as needed, and really try to make those decisions or help the commission make their decisions in 2018. So just kind of getting into the regulations a little bit, and I will maybe take this opportunity before we dive into the regulations to say that the regulations isn't the only document or product of this effort. The regulations are required so folks know how to quantify, manage their benefits, and have some ground rules for the program. But we're also working on application instructions, which will provide the details of how do I fill out my application, what are the due dates, what are some workshop dates for completing my applications. And then part of that application instructions, which is a very important part, is a technical appendix. We realize when you read the regulations, it's going to sound like a heavy lift for a lot of projects, and it is, and we admit that. We know it's very complex. These projects are going to be complex. Just water management in California is complex. So we're really going to try to provide as much technical guidance as possible. We can't, you know, feed everyone that this is the model that you should use and the techniques that you can use, because there's too much variety in the types of projects that we'll see, but we can at least provide some, hey, you might want to look at this for data sets or these types of models or these types of analysis, because there is that information out there and can kind of provide a starting point for project applicants. So the regulations, you'll see that the first section, section 6000, is the definitions. We've included a lot of definitions at this point, and that's been something that our stakeholder group has really asked for, that we started out with a much more streamlined list of definitions, but just to make sure that there's clarity within the regulations, we've included all definitions that we've received any questions on. Section 6001 is the general provisions, and when you flip to that section, you'll see it mostly deals with who are the eligible applicants, what are the eligible projects, and that's a short section. The general selection process, that starts to get into a little bit meatier content when we're talking about the two-step application process and the multiple-step review process that each application will go through, that including the completeness and eligibility check, a technical review, an independent peer review, and then finally, the commission's decision process. Once the commission makes their decisions, we'll move on to the funding commitments, and that's in section 6003, which details all of the various steps for the commission to make a conditional funding commitment all the way to a final funding commitment. Section 6004 is probably the section you want to read if you're having trouble sleeping tonight. It's the quantification of public benefits. It starts to get a little technical, and we've tried to at least provide a clear framework for how benefits can be quantified. But one of the things that we want it to do is to keep that section flexible. There's many ways to quantify public benefits. There's not one right answer, but we did want to specify some common assumptions between the projects. So when we get project applications in, people are calling it an apples-to-apples comparison, but I like to call it an apples-to-oranges comparison, because we're not going to get exactly the same thing, but as long as we can stay in the fruit realm, you know, at least we can make some decisions on it and make sure that everyone's at least at the same level. Section 6005 and 6006, the priorities and relative environmental value, You'll hear a lot about those in the next section, so I'll skip over a summary. And then managing public benefits, you know, that's really an important part of these regulations and what the commission is trying to do, because it's really managing those public benefits that ensures that these public benefits are provided over the life of the project. And we want to make sure that these public benefits are resilient to changing futures, and that benefits that are claimed now will be resilient to climate change or new conditions, and really wanting to make sure that this public investment is in these public funds are spent well. Other things that we're requiring under the management of public benefits is documentation of public benefits. And a big theme you'll see in the priorities and relative value is adaptive management. So if you've got your project operations and conditions change in the future, or you're not hitting your public benefit targets, what are you going to do about it? What decisions are you going to make? And so we're asking for folks to provide some kind of monitoring assurances and reporting planning. And another thing that's required in the statute that you'll see reflected in the regulations that you have in front of you is that project proponents are going to have to enter into contracts with the public agencies that are administering the public benefits. So that's Department of Water Resources, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the State Water Board to make some commitments on how these public benefits will be managed in the future. So with that, questions?
So we are asking those that are able to step in line, but I know you had a question. That way we can both see you speaking for the webcast and also make sure the mic's on you.
Where's the line?
You're first. Yes.
Okay, well, maybe I'm in the wrong place. I thought this was going to help agriculture. There's no agriculture at all? And it is, how much money was it all together? There's $2.7 billion here. How much money was the whole project that we voted on for number one?
So the first question is generally about Proposition 1 and then a question about agriculture specifically.
Yeah, how much, I was just wondering, is there, how much was the whole thing?
So for Proposition 1, Chapter 8, it was $2.7 billion for the public benefits of water storage projects. And water supply for ag or urban or M&I is generally considered a non-public benefit, but this money fills an important gap for a lot of projects that have been studied for a long time. And
well, my question was, how much was the total amount of
$7.5 billion was
well,
the.
What's all the other money for?
You know, I'm not super familiar with all the other
so
chapters. I don't know if anyone else here is.
I'm a 60-year Farm Bureau director for Contra Costa County, and I've been 6 years. I've been up in Sacramento for the State Board. And so I'm familiar with agriculture. You know, there's 77,000 farms in California, and 98% are family farms, not
what you hear. Can you speak closer?
Not what you hear in the papers. 98% are family farms. And we need water. And I was just wondering, how's the rest of the money supposed to be? It's supposed to be for, if this here, what you were talking about today, if we're going to build a dam, the dam has to be eco stuff, not has to be for people to have their gardens and have their farms and stuff. I've been a flower farmer. I'm an advisor now. I'm 85, but I've been for 65 years, and I've been growing flowers. And all the flower growers are going to go bankrupt this year because they spent all the money to get their crop out, and people aren't buying the flowers. You know, they say, "Well, you don't have enough water," but what I was trying to ask is, maybe I'm in the wrong place. What does the eco stuff have to do with trying to have storage? The storage is another part, or what? Am I missing something? I read a lot of this stuff here, but I'm kind of old and I read slow. But you know, our 77,000 family farms, we need water. And only contrary to what people don't know, that 80 out of our runoff, 78 million acre feet of runoff that we have every year in California, only 11% is for the domestic, for everything, and industry, houses, everything. 41% is for agriculture, and 48% is for eco stuff. And like the big portion of the nine North Coast rivers, we don't touch one drop of that water. You know, there was something like 7 trillion gallons of water went down into the ocean this last year, and we couldn't touch a drop of it. That would be something like 170,000 gallons for every man, woman, and child of the 38 million people we have. So I'm missing something here. Are we trying to make something to help the fish and help the eco and make people feel good? And I know we spent a lot of money 35 years ago with the Delta plan, and we were going to have some reservoirs, but it was all spent on eco stuff, all spent on habitat. We didn't get one dam. Instead of getting a dam, they blew up. We had the foundations made for the Auburn Dam, and they spent money blowing up all the foundations for that, so we can't have the Auburn Dam. But my question is, how agriculture has nothing to do with what we're talking in here tonight?
No, water supply is a very important part of what we're talking about tonight, but this is money that was made available for the public benefits of water storage projects. And so the public benefits are those that can be shared by all Californians.
Water storage project is a dam? I'm missing what you're saying.
Yes, that is a water
storage. Is it storage?
Yes. Sir, that could be eligible.
Because they had all kinds of other stuff here.
I'm going to remind everybody, because we are live webcast, if we can wait and take turns when we're speaking. So
sure. Specific
on the water storage.
But I'm probably the only one on this side, so I should have half or at least 25%. Probably everybody else here are all eco-freaks, you know. I don't know.
No, we've done a lot.
Against agriculture, against the family farms.
We've done a lot of public meetings where water storage for farms is a big concern for folks. And on Wednesday, we're going to be in Clovis. And so that's a very important.
So this 2.7 is just part of that. The other rest of the money is going for something else?
Out of the 7.5, yes, there's other programs. There's other chapters that deal with groundwater, emergency funds for dealing with the current drought, and there's other ecosystem programs. But just to get back to the water supply, historically all water projects are multi-purpose. And a big purpose of that is water supply for ag, water supply for M&I, and that's generally paid for by the ratepayers. So we consider those non-public benefits. And so to
The public all eats the food. You know, everybody here looks like they're well, like they've had plenty to eat, you know. And our 98% of our farms are family farms. And lucky this year, most of them had water, but I don't know what's going to happen in the future. There were some problems. But go ahead.
Well, this money will hopefully support projects that have been in formulation or are currently being formulated to respond to future droughts, you know, get off the ground. Because
but
this
I
is
didn't
a public
see anything
infusion.
I read here. Nothing said the word agriculture.
But agriculture is a big part of the cost share component. So
nobody printed it in any of these papers.
No, because that's where the other 50% of project cost share would come from. This is a state investment for the five public benefits identified in Prop 1 that'll help projects get off the ground, that will provide water storage, water supply benefits to ratepayers.
Okay, but we feel real bad in agriculture because 48% of our water is controlled by the government already. We couldn't touch a drop of that because a big portion of that is in the North Coast rivers, and those are wild rivers. And you can't have, and Governor Brown said that he doesn't count green energy is not hydro, so he won't count any hydro as green energy. It has to be from solar and wind. And of course, we can have a lot of hydro that's clean energy if we build dams up there. But I probably talked too much already, but I'll shut up.
If you have additional comments, you're welcome to get back in line, but I do want to make sure we have opportunity for everyone to ask questions. So you're next.
My name is Sonia Diermeyer. I reserve my comments for later, for the final. I hope there will be time at the final comment period. But I do have some questions. One, if you could describe just briefly who is on the stakeholder advisory committee, what organizations or entities are on that. And then another question, I don't know if you can do this briefly, just clarify a little bit what continuous appropriation means.
Yeah, of course. For the Stakeholder Advisory Committee, it's a group of 35 organizations that kind of bridge a cross-section of potential project proponents, interest groups and organizations representing agriculture, environment, human right to water, so environmental justice. And so we had a large suite of stakeholders involved that crossed a lot of interest. And on our website, if you wanted to see the roster of the Stakeholder Advisory Committee, that's posted. And then for the second question on continuous appropriation, I'm going to see if Rachel can answer that one. She's our finance person.
So continuous appropriation, most of the money that was in the bond was dedicated to specific purposes and specific agencies to administer grant programs. But during the annual budget cycle, those agencies would go to the legislature and ask for a specific amount to be allocated to their program for that fiscal year. What continuous appropriation means is that the commission doesn't have to go back to the legislature each year to ask for a specific portion of that $2.7 billion for that year. So it creates a little bit more flexibility, especially when dealing with such large projects or potentially large projects.
So the projects could be multi-year projects spanning, you know, up to 10 years or something and already get pre-appropriated from the beginning, so to speak?
So the projects, you know, the commission will make an initial funding commitment, as Jenny was describing, in the process after a technical review. But then there are still some requirements that those projects would have to meet before the commission created a final funding commitment. So those are things like finalizing their environmental documentation, getting all of the necessary permits and water rights, and having complete feasibility studies. But at that point, when the commission does give the final commitment of funding, the funding would actually go out as the project was constructed. So the project proponents would do the construction, spend the money, and then they would invoice the commission. And so some of those projects take years to build, and so the funding would be going out over years. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Sir?
Yes, my name is Mark Jonas. I'm a hydrologist with Cardinal, and it has to do with the term eligible applicants. And when I look at the water code, you know, Division 26.7, eligible applicants, public agencies, nonprofit organizations, public utilities, federally recognized Indian tribes, and state recognized tribes. Now, when we look at the requirements for what an applicant needs to do, program cost shall be shared 50% of the total cost, so it'll be cost sharing. So that it looks like that, well, who would you suspect would be an applicant? It seems like, I think you were stating that you really have quite a high bar of what an applicant needs to do in order to be that. But we're talking about nonprofits, Indian tribes. So who would you expect to be an applicant?
And those are certainly eligible applicants, and we have had conversations with the Stakeholder Advisory Committee of you know, there's there's certain levels of expectation for different types of applicants. And for applicants for projects such as the CalFed projects, they've been studied for a long time. There's a high level of technical capacity there, and Contra Costa Water District, sites JPA, the newly developed or being developed Friant JPA, and those are potential applicants with a high level of sophistication who are within the regulations. We've tried to set kind of minimum requirements, and so where there's various levels of technical detail, they're definitely going to be held to the highest bar. But there's areas of flexibility within the regulation that say if you don't think this is applicable to your project, or it may not be a necessary analysis due to the size of the project, you can qualitatively describe some things. So there, we've tried to set, at least minimum bars for some of the smaller agencies that would apply for funding, and then the bar kind of gets raised for a level of sophistication based on kind of the technical complexity of the project.
Okay, thank you for that answer. I have one more question here, and it concerns permits. And I'm reading here, specifically, each funding recipient shall demonstrate the following items of the Water Code have been completed. Environmental documentation associated with projects have been completed. All required permits have been secured. Okay, that's pretty clear. But we look at the next section. It talks about funding for permits. And it looks like there's some funding mechanism where you can help people acquire permits, but we're not talking about any funding until 2017. So how does that work, the requirements for permits, and then funding to help people get permits?
There's some timing. So when the applications come in, the requirements for content in the application are completed feasibility studies, but only a draft environmental document, and you don't have to have any of your permits at the time you apply. So the commission's going to make what we're calling a conditional funding commitment that says, this is the amount of money based on the public benefits claimed at this point in time that the commission will set aside for your project. And then there could be a variable amount of time between this conditional commitment to a final condition while projects are working on their final environmental document, securing all their permits, and doing a list of other approvals and necessary operations, finalizing their operations, getting into contract with the public agencies. So there's a list of things that have to happen between the conditional funding commitment and the final funding commitment. And part of that ask in your conditional funding equipment could be a request for assistance in permitting. So that would happen in that post-conditional before final commitment stage.
Excellent. Very clear.
Oh, good.
The issue of a CEQA requirement where you look at mitigation. Mm-hmm. Now, they talk about completion of CEQA prior to even applying in some cases under Prop 1. But how's CEQA EIR going to fit in as far as permits and requirements?
So for this program, the requirement and application is a public draft CEQA document. So you could still be in your draft phases, but to actually encumber funds and start receiving any reimbursement, you've got to have your final CEQA document completed.
And the CEQA, you can get funding for completion of the CEQA document? Or at, just the permits?
It would be a reimbursable cost, but not at, we haven't equated it at that same point in time where the permitting money could be available.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah. I appreciate it.
All right. We will move on to our next agenda item. I will remind everyone that we will have time both after this next presentations. We're going to tag team between our two presenters, and then we will have an opportunity for clarifying questions on those presentations, and then at 7:20 we will open up for general comments and questions or any questions or comments that you weren't able to ask earlier. So with that, I'd like to present Jenny again, who will then present Scott Cantrell and Gail Link.
All right, I promise this is the last time you'll hear from me for a little while. I'm just going to set the stage for the priorities and the relative environmental value. So this slide reflects what was in Proposition 1, that Fish and Wildlife and the State Water Board were going to provide priorities and relative environmental values for the ecosystem improvements and the water quality improvements. And how I've been kind of sorting out what priorities mean versus relative environmental values, if I was a project applicant, I would look at the priorities and think about how I could formulate my project to achieve any of the priorities that were set forth by Fish and Wildlife or State Board. So I would use these priorities to formulate my project. And then once the applications come in to the commission, part of the review team will be Fish and Wildlife staff and State Board staff, and we'll be working together to determine a relative environmental value for the project. So we're not going to be asking project proponents to determine their relative environmental value, but that is something that the staff and technical review team will be doing. So when Scott and Gail are doing their presentations, they'll be telling you what the priorities are, so what are the different things or objectives that project proponents should formulate to, and then they'll step through the criteria for their relative environmental value, which will let projects know how staff and the technical review team will be evaluating each of these criteria to come up with a relative environmental value. And that relative environmental value will be project versus project and will likely be something that's, you know, high, medium, low for relative environmental value on ecosystem improvements and water quality improvements. So with that introduction, I'm going to turn it over to Scott Cantrell with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and he's going to talk about their priorities for ecosystem improvements.
Thank you, Jenny. Again, my name is Scott Cantrell. I'm the chief of our water branch in the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. And so I'm going to spend no more than 10 minutes just giving you an update on where we are with our priorities. And then I'm going to hand it off to Gail, and she'll talk about the water quality priorities. And then we'll follow up with the description of relative environmental values. So we've been working on this, as you know, if you've been tracking this at all, for the last, 5 or 6 months, very intensively working with the Water Board and DWR and the Commission staff. And the content of our priorities is essentially the same as what you've seen over the last several months. We have condensed the number of priorities and the language to make them much more concise and hopefully more useful to applicants. And we've grouped our priorities into two broad categories. The first category is flow and water quality, and the second category is called physical processes and habitat. And I'm going to describe these and give some examples of each. We've also been working with the State Water Board on the description of relative environmental values and trying to identify where we have overlapping concerns, particularly with environmental water quality. And we've also been working together on the definition of terms, which is in Section 6000 of the regulation. So, go to the next. This first slide here depicts the first five priorities in the flow and water quality category. And as we know by best available science, flow and water quality are key drivers of fish species abundance, distribution, and overall viability of populations. The magnitude, timing, duration, and stability of flows are critical to the overall survival of native fish and wildlife. So projects that can be operated to emulate a more natural hydrograph and provide appropriate water quality conditions that will support native fish and wildlife populations is one of our key priorities. So the first three on this list are pertaining to the flow and water quality, the pattern and magnitude of flows, and the natural hydrograph. Then the next two priorities, number four and five on this list, deal with water quality and upstream passage of migratory fish. And these are factors such as water quality constituents of temperature, dissolved oxygen, nutrients, and salinity. These are also shared priorities of the State Water Board. And essentially higher flows can improve water quality. Fast-moving water tends to maintain more dissolved oxygen and is colder. And these are all conditions that are conducive to healthy fish populations. And then number six And number 7 up on the screen, these are priorities aimed at enhancing attraction flows for migratory fish. And we know that fish that can key in on the scent of water in which they spawned, they will be attracted to those watersheds, and those are called the natal streams. And so providing higher flow on those streams will help the fish cue in on those natal streams. And also delta outflow is important for delta smelt, longfin smelt, and other estuarine fishes. And then the last priority on this list pertains to groundwater and surface water interconnection. And the intent here is that we like projects to formulate, where applicable, operations that will improve in-stream flow benefits for fish and wildlife to maintain conditions conducive for migration and rearing of fish, and also to support riparian vegetation. And these are things like creating surface wetlands, meadows, springs, and seeps, and so on, to provide habitat for aquatic plants and animals. So the next category is called physical processes and habitat. And Roman numeral 1 through 3, these are all aimed at enhancing flow regimes, floodplains, and habitat diversity to support fish and wildlife. And over the last 150 years, we know the landscape has been substantially altered through channel and floodplain modification and so on. And so floodplain is a very beneficial habitat for rearing and growth of young fish species. And so project operations that can increase the frequency and magnitude and duration of floodplains is a priority of the department. And these enhanced floodplains also provide other ancillary ecosystem benefits. So the next couple priorities on this list, number 4 and 5, are aimed at improving fish passage and downstream emigration by reducing barriers to migration and entrainment into diversions. And so these are the types of actions to provide for increased access to natal streams, putting on state-of-the-art fish screens on screen diversions, and reducing entrainment overall of fish can improve fish survival. Next set, number 6 and number 7, these priorities pertain to providing water for riparian and wetlands habitat, including managed wetlands, and also to control non-native invasive species. So we know that wetlands and riparian habitats are very critical to migratory birds of the Pacific flyway, neotropical migrants, and a variety of other native species. And providing water to these habitat types increases their area and availability and connectivity. And we also know that reducing the impacts of invasive species on natives can reduce competition and provide more physical space for native species. And so the final priority in this category, number 8, is to enhance habitat for native species that have commercial, recreational, scientific, and educational value. And these are all values, core values of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. They're part of our mission. And so I'm going to next turn it over to Gail Link from the State Water Board, and she'll discuss the water quality priorities, and then I'll be back up with the mic talking about our relative environmental values.
Well, good evening. I'm Gail Link. I'm an Environmental Program Manager with the State Water Board. As Jenny mentioned, the Water Board is, with regard to this water storage investment program, has been charged with providing priorities and relative environmental value of water quality improvement benefits. The water quality improvement, or the water quality priorities that I'm going to provide an overview on tonight, do not represent all of the Water Board's priorities, but they are those that we've identified as having the potential to positively be influenced by water storage projects. We recognize the importance of the connections between water quality and quantity, and also the connections between water quality and ecosystem benefits that Scott just summarized. We've identified 9 draft priorities. This slide shows the first 5. I'll note that in your handout, number 5 is on the next slide, but they're here all together because they all have to do with water quality parameters for which we have waters in the state that are impaired. It means they're not meeting the water quality objectives. And we have a list of impaired water bodies under the Clean Water Act requirements in Section 303D. And these, the water bodies for these parameters, which are temperature, dissolved oxygen, nutrient, mercury, and salinity, they're listed. All these water bodies are listed and posted on the Commission's website if you're interested in the details. You will probably notice that these parameters are often related to each other with regard to a water storage project design or operations. For example, flows will affect several of these parameters, and we could see improvements that would address one or more of these priorities. On the next slide, we have a different set, our next 4 priorities. And they include pertain to the water quality improvements associated with groundwater, stream flows, water demand, and the human right to water. Number 6 is to protect, clean up, or restore groundwater resources in CASGEM high and medium priority basins. And for those of you not familiar, CASGEM is the California Statewide Groundwater Elevation Monitoring Program. Number 7 is to achieve delta tributary stream flows that resemble natural hydrograph, very similar to some of the things Scott just went over for ecosystem priorities. Number 8, reducing current or future water demand on the delta by developing local water supplies. And then number 9, consistent with the Human Right to Water Act that was adopted in 2012, our priority of the Water Board is to provide water for basic human needs such as drinking, cooking, and bathing in disadvantaged communities or similarly situated communities where those needs are not met. So that's it.
Thank you, Gail. So next I'm going to describe the relative environmental values, and this is in the regulation section 6006. And we recognize that projects will make contributions to these priorities and ecosystem benefits in various ways, and they will vary greatly. And that what we're going to be looking for in these project proposals are specific information such as the number and magnitude and mix of benefits, the location and timing of benefits, and how long these benefits persist. And that we would also need to see clearly stated goals and objectives for ecosystem improvements, including monitoring and adaptive management programs and strategies to provide for resilience in the face of climate change. So I'm going to walk through these quickly. The first relative environmental value is the number of ecosystem priorities addressed by the project. And these are the ones that were on the previous slides in those 2 categories, so I won't reiterate though. But the general idea is that the more priorities a project can incorporate, the better. The second relative environmental value is regarding the magnitude and certainty of ecosystem improvements. And magnitude is essentially defined as the quantity and scale of the improvement. And certainty is the conventional sense of certainty. It's the likelihood of successful outcomes. The third relative environmental value is spatial and temporal scale of ecosystem improvements. And again, these are the conventional meanings of space and time. So Spatial scale refers to the geographical dimensions of the improvement, and temporal scale is the scheduled time in which the improvement would occur. The fourth relative environmental value is the inclusion of an adaptive management and monitoring program that includes measurable objectives, performance measures, thresholds, and triggers for managing ecosystem benefits. And as Jenny said earlier, there is a requirement to manage public benefits over time. And so it's going to be important in order to evaluate these ecosystem outcomes to have some way to assess the status and trends of progress towards achieving these improvements. As well as thresholds and triggers should these improvements not be playing out as planned. Number five is the immediacy of ecosystem improvement actions and the realization of benefits. And this is basically, when does the improvement begin to show up? And when would the accrual of benefits occur over time? Number six is the duration of improvements. So how long is the project going to be providing those benefits? And then seven is consistency with recovery plans and strategies and initiatives and conservation plans. And number eight is the location of the ecosystem improvements and connectivity to other areas that are already being protected. This is the idea of providing interconnected habitats and migration corridors for species, and also providing larger blocks of protected areas where possible. So it's large areas and interconnected habitats that we're aiming at in this relative environmental value. Number nine is the efficient use of water to achieve multiple ecosystem benefits. So if there's a block of water that could do double or triple duty to have large outcomes with small amounts of water, I mean, that would be the ideal situation. So for example, water released from an upstream reservoir, if that block of water could provide an in-stream flow benefit of cold water and then be used for downstream seasonal wetlands, and then also be conjunctively recharged to a depleted groundwater aquifer, I mean, that would be an example of an efficient use of water. And then the final relative environmental value that we've identified is resilience of ecosystem improvements to the effects of climate change. And these are things that we know are going to change, such as hydrology, increasing water temperatures, sea level rise, and salinity intrusion in the delta. So we felt this was a very important relative environmental value that would, that project could address. So now I'll turn it back to Gail, and she'll discuss the relative environmental values where they are different from the ecosystem values that I just outlined.
Okay, so we're talking about the relative environmental values for water quality priorities. Just as a reminder, these are generally considered the factors that we'll be using in assessing the extent to which the competing water storage projects would achieve the water quality priorities, as Jenny mentioned, used for like between project comparisons. So the first six that are up on the slide right now, they are the same as the relative environmental values that Scott just went over for ecosystems. So we've determined that these same types of values would also apply to water quality improvements. On the next slide, we have 7, 8, and 9. Number 7 is very much like the ecosystem value. Instead of species restoration or conservation plans, for the Water Board, it's water quality plans and policies and consistency with the SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. Also, number 8 is a lot like one of the ecosystem priorities, connectivity of water quality improvements to areas that support the beneficial use of water or are managed for water quality. So we realize that improvements from a water storage project that are adjacent to an area that already is improved is better than an isolated improvement that is separate from. And of course, those would all be determined case by case. And number nine, just like ecosystem resilience of the water quality improvement to climate change impacts. On the next slide, we have a couple more. And number 10 relates to our priority regarding basic providing water for basic human needs. So this would just be the extent to which those improvements did provide for those needs. And that this one and number 11 are unique to water quality, not a comparable ecosystem or relative value. So number 11 is the extent to which undesirable results are caused by groundwater extractions are addressed.
Okay, thank you, Gail.
Thank you. Now, we pretty much have time to hear from the rest of you. If you want to focus your questions specific to questions and comments on the last presentation, you can do that. Please feel free to line up at the mic. And then also just general comments. The bulk of the rest of our time here is to hear from you, comments, questions, whether to clarify or just general comments. So again, we're going to line up at the mic. I ask that you please give deference to other folks who might want to make a comment. So just ask one question at a time and then move back to the end of the line. And we can start the QA now.
Okay. This time I have fewer questions and more comments. I was very pleased to see the list of Department of Fish and Wildlife and State Water Resources Control Board priorities. Those all look extremely like very powerful benefits to the general public and the state as a whole. I would urge the priorities to continue to focus away from expensive and environmentally damaging dams, which seems to me just a no-brainer that a dam would not fulfill many of those or would violate many of those priorities and would be an expensive use of taxpayer money for very few benefits. I would encourage any kind of priorities and definitions that that favor groundwater management, environmentally sensitive groundwater management. We have much greater storage capacity there than in all of the dams put together that we have now or we could create with this money. I'm a bit concerned about whether local innovative projects such as rainwater capture and storage and stormwater runoff and storage in urban areas would be clearly enough, would fit these priorities or would be considered for fulfilling the priorities as they are somewhat maybe distant from where the benefits would be realized. So if we're talking about benefiting the Delta, for example, or San Francisco Bay flows, I think it would be very difficult perhaps to precisely limit and quantify the benefits of capturing rainwater off of all the warehouses in the Bay Area and the Los Angeles Basin and using that and to free up water to remain in the Sacramento and San Joaquin rivers. That would be a high priority for me, would be to see those resources funded and used that are available and are vastly underutilized right now, rainwater capture, stormwater runoff and capture. I would love it if some of this money were also used for better utilizing reoperation of reservoir storage, even though that there's probably institutional difficulties there, but that should be a high priority too. And I think also I just want to add one little comment that I think it's important to make sure that this taxpayer-approved borrowing power is not used to maintain unrealistic promises of water for agriculture that is non-food essential and is not providing jobs or economic benefits for the entire state, and particularly the cultivation of toxic and less appropriate soils in parts of the Westlands area. Thank you.
I'd like to address a couple things that you just said. One of them is that if you look at the other sections of Prop 1, things like stormwater capture are covered. And I would recommend for everyone in the room to take a look at the list of benefits that are available through Prop 1. This is only about the Water Storage Improvement Program, and you're exactly right, that there has to be benefits to the Delta. And in the meetings of the commission, there have been a number of discussions about we're really looking forward to innovative proposals that take advantage of strategies of recharging groundwater basins. We all see that as a really critical and, as you said, a very sustainable water storage opportunity in the state. And one thing I want to clarify with the gentleman who was talking about farming and agriculture, and that is that just to sort of put this in context, I serve on a water commission where I live, on a water board, rather, where I live. And if we were to build any water storage today outside of looking to Prop 1 for benefit, we would have to, in our budget, include money for environmental benefit. So we would have, by taking water out of the environment, we would be able to allocate a portion of that for, you know, for home use and for agricultural use, but then a portion would have to be held and delivered to the environmental systems affected by the new storage. And I want to make it very clear that, sir, in this funding in section or chapter 8 is actually just for that portion of water project proposals or water storage proposals. So if a proponent comes in with a water project that's going to benefit agriculture and communities, what this money does is it helps support the cost that those ag users and communities would have to pay for the environmental benefit portion. So this isn't money that would build an entire project just for environmental benefit. What it actually does is it partners with storage, water storage proponents and alleviates a bit of that burden. So I just wanted to be clear. I don't know if that helped.
Well, we have heard of this relative environmental value and the priorities, et cetera, which are reasonable approach, doable. However, you know, it's very difficult for me to understand, okay, these relative environmental values and priorities are good in sorting out some of the what you call public benefit alternatives. However, the critical issue here is, as the law is written, that 50% of the cost has to be public benefit. And so we have to, okay, going back, you know, the problem I have, which I'll share with this gentleman here, is that California has an enormous water problem today, as everybody knows. And it's getting worse because our natural storage system, Sierra snowpack, is no longer dependable. Okay, the only really effective solution is to create storage. And that's why many people voted, including myself, voted for Proposition 1, believing that at least $2.7 billion of that will be used for storage construction. But we were duped. And so, and because of this $2.7 billion is for the public benefit portion of the storage projects. So the other 50% has to be funded locally or privately or whatever, outside this Proposition 1 money. So then question becomes, how do we establish that, okay, 50% of what we might do is a public benefit? Okay, your relative values, et cetera, does not really help to support any case that, okay, this project has a 50% public benefit. I would appreciate it if, for example, you could tell us how a project like a Sites Reservoir could be funded by this Proposition 1, some sort of a hypothetical scenario that this can be done. Because as I see it, there's absolutely no chance that we can use Prop 1 money for Sites Reservoir. And yet that was kind of exactly the hope that we had. We voted for this Prop 1 thinking that, okay, now we can have this dam or that dam to compensate for the lack of rain, lack of Serapac. And then another irony is that apparently the agriculture that feeds and sustains the life of the people of California, of the United States, of the world, is not a public benefit. And so, okay, that has to be scratched out. So not even the equation in the relative value. And so how can you really sort of, can anybody justify that any large storage project could be eligible for this Proposition 1 funding? And I see it, there are only two alternative solutions. One is that you put some dollar values to the environmental or what you call public value, which recreation is perhaps easiest one to put the dollar value on. But water quality and environmental improvements, that's very hard because economists have been trying to do that for the past decades and nobody came to an agreement. Or you put what you excluded from the public benefit into the group of objects for your relative values. Because otherwise, I don't see any way that any major project can claim to be eligible for the funding. Anyway, so that's my comments.
No, thank you. It's a very, very good comments and questions, and I'll try to clarify a few things. So the relative environmental values are not tied to any economics. They're a relative value being high, medium, low, but and would not go into the calculation of the 50% cost share for public benefits. That is done separately. And the section on method of quantification of benefits in the regulation touches on that. And so when folks are going to be asked to quantify their public benefits, there's multiple steps in there. And you know, one, of course, is figuring out what the physical change in the with and without project conditions are, and then looking at those physical changes, trying to determine what's a potential benefit, what's a potential impact, and then monetizing those benefits and impacts. And then once you can have your economic values of your public benefits, then you can compare it to the value of the non-public benefits. So there is a requirement within the regulations to the maximum extent possible to monetize your benefits so the commission can do the 50% to 50% comparison. And I did want to maybe talk about a hypothetical loosely based on Sites Reservoir, just to explain that this program is about water supply, and it is about getting projects built and providing public benefits and maximizing the state investment in those. And I'm rounding and loosely basing things on a North of Delta off-stream storage that, let's say, costs $4 billion, and I'm rounding up. That is something at the current state or prior to Prop 1 that this the JPA or the public agency that existed for that project and any other partners that they would have, if it was the federal government or other local partners, because there was no state funding available, they would split that $4 billion. And now there's a pot of state money available that puts the state in a cost-share position for up to 50% of that. So if Sites Reservoir or North of Delta Offstream Storage example were to apply for funding and have 50% public benefits, they could request $2 billion worth of funding that would come from the state, which means the locals would only have to make up that other $2 billion. So it does provide that extra boost of state funding to make sure that projects can get built.
How can, because, okay, suppose I were promoting such a reservoir, and I say, okay, 50% is a public benefit, but other people can argue, no, it's not. And because I cannot say it is or it isn't. You know, there's no way, and you can't say it is or it isn't. Who is that going to be the judge?
We've got a lot of different steps in this process to make checks and balances on if potential benefits are public or non-public. One of the things is at the plan formulation stage, when project proponents are formulating their projects, it's not storage no longer our single benefit. Everyone's always planning for multiple benefits. And most of the project proponents that we're dealing with right now are already planning projects for many purposes. And they know that Proposition 1 money is out there. So they're aggressively planning for making sure that their projects provide public benefits. And we've tried to develop the regulations so it's very clear what types of benefits would be eligible for funding. And so when an applicant is putting together their application and determining how to formulate their project, they're using the regulation and the future technical guidance that will be provided early next year and the priorities to try to maximize the amount of public benefit provided by the project. And once they tell their story and submit their application, it'll go through a technical review, an independent peer review, and the final review of the commission to say, they said this was a public benefit, this is how they quantified it, this is the quality of their analysis, and at all three levels, we'll be verifying that, yes, indeed, we think this is an eligible public benefit. It's not going to be easy, but we're going to do our best.
So we have about 30 minutes left for open comments, and I know we've got folks wanting to sit down. We're going to have to stick with the QE in the line, so I believe, ma'am, you were next. Just to make sure that we can hear everybody at the mic and get you on the live webcast. Go ahead.
So good evening. I'll be brief. I'm Leah Orloff from Contra Costa Water District. I just wanted to take advantage of this open mic to thank you all for coming out to the community. We are one of those potential project proponents that has served on the Stakeholder Advisory Committee. We've really appreciated the open and transparent process, and we are another example of one of those projects that is being developed to provide regional water supply benefits as well as ecosystem and water quality benefits. So thank you again for coming, and we look forward to continuing to work with you.
Sir? Yep.
Yes, thank you, staff. You've done wonderful work and extensive effort throughout the last year. I asked this question out of naivete. Say we have a public facility such as a reservoir. Do we place appraised value on that so that Wall Street can then invest in it, thinking they can collateralize against it?
I'm going to ask for your card and talk to my economist and then get back to you.
Because I have Wall Street asking me per this. It's like, do we have appraised value? Didn't, yeah. I mean, if we inflate it. No, but you know, that might give them incentive to invest.
Yeah.
And we need to raise as much money as, because what Murkowski and the Senate bill in the U.S. Senate is, they're allocating $500 million, and that's just not enough for matching funds. So we really got a rock over there, too. So
there's certainly a place for private investment, but kind of how the scenario that you laid out, to have an intelligent answer, I'd like to go back to my technical team.
Ben Lubon, Jude Benedict and Associates, just a little firm.
Thanks.
And we will get your card, sir. Go ahead.
In the early 2000s, I had a contract with the Bureau of Reclamation to do a conveyance study. I just pulled out of my file, north of Delta offsite storage investigation, and it was under the CalFed Bay Delta program. My question concerns, is the Fed going to step up and help pay for sites? And what will it take to have that happen?
That's an excellent question, and I can't speak on their behalf, but I know they've been very involved in the CalFed programs, and they are working hand-in-hand with the locals to develop a federal-level feasibility study, and they are working on EISs, so the NEPA environmental document for the CalFed studies, and so they are, you know, stepping up and working on the CalFed planning side of things, but as far as Congress authorizing funding for the construction of the projects, that's a hurdle that's going to, you know, that all the projects are still going to have to overcome, and I'm not sure, you know, I can't speak for the federal side, but they are, knowing the folks over at Reclamation who are working on this project, that is certainly a goal of theirs.
Okay.
And they would like to, you know, participate and be a funding partner in these programs. And they are very active in their participation of attending commission meetings and attending the stakeholder advisory committee meetings and being really up to speed and up to date on what's happening on the state side. So I know it's certainly a goal of theirs. And they're doing everything they can to get federal authorization to build the projects.
Good. I think we'll need it. Is there anybody else in line? I can ask my second question now, or should I wait?
Please wait, since we have two people in line. Thank you.
Evening. My name's Heinrich Albert. I'm from Alameda. I want to start by speaking to the folks that are here that have been representing ag. I'm retired now. But when I worked for a seed company. So I was not an actual honest farmer, but I was dependent on ag. And indeed, as you've pointed out, I benefit from the food crops and fiber crops that you folks grow, and it's very high quality, and it's very inexpensive. So that's great. But in a state with all these beautiful rivers, and every single one of those rivers is already dammed, except for two. Only the Smith River and the Cosumnes River are not dammed. And most of those rivers have multiple dams. I think we need to, when we look at the public benefits of new surface storage, we need to take that into account. And I think it's really true that it's going to be very difficult to balance out the public benefits, because these reservoirs, they do a huge amount of damage to the environment, which is what is really valuable to me as a consumer in California. So I really hope that we keep a sharp pencil on this and don't take fake benefits when we're calculating that. The last thing, and this is a question, it does seem to me that underground storage has got a lot of merits. The environmental impacts are much less severe than surface storage, and the cost, I think, could be way less. It seems to me that the very slow implementation of the different aspects of SGMA means that for many years in the future, people will have no sort of certainty that if they put water into ground storage, that they'll be able to get that back out. Can you say anything about the sort of the viability of that option as proposals in the project, given that people will think, well, some landowner that's a little bit further down on this aquifer is just going to pump this water all out? Thank you.
Jenny, and then Commissioner.
You know, we've had a lot of folks come and talk to the commission, and the commissioners have gone and visited proposed sites and projects. And some of, not sites, I didn't mean the site north of the Delta storage, but we've gone to different locations, and there are existing irrigation districts that are actually looking at their operations and looking how they can include recharge as a part of their footprint. And it's really encouraging that existing irrigation districts throughout the state are really considering sort of the multiple benefits that they can get to their water supply by expanding, in essence, their portfolio. And I think that, you know, there are, you know, as you said, there are surface storage projects. There's also reoperation opportunities. So there are folks who have existing storage facilities that could be, you know, revamped, if you will. But I understand what you're saying and take it to heart. And we, again, the commission has looked very hard at looking how we actually can really make this money work in benefiting water supply for the state of California, and that is for ag, for communities, and for the environment. And we also have spoken quite a bit at the meetings about really wanting to spend these dollars wisely. And I think we're fortunate. I think we have an amazing team to work with, and we really do take all your comments to heart and to mind. Okay, so thanks.
Well, dams are the very most important thing, and if we don't have the dams, there's no way you can recharge water in the ground if you don't have a dam and catch it. It's foolish to think the water is going to run down in the water. Some will, but very little. You have to get it in a dam first and then recharge it in the water. And I was going to ask the Fish and Wildlife State gentleman here a couple of questions. Does your organization want to have the two big tunnels? Those tunnels are 40 feet. So 40 feet like that and bigger than the wide, two of those 40-foot tunnels. Is that, are you endorsing those, the Fish and Game, or not Fish and Game anymore, I guess State Fish and Wildlife, are you endorsing those tunnels? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I've heard of them, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jenny, do you want to answer that? I don't know that we're supposed to opine on other major policy initiatives during this session.
Well, I thought, don't answer that. The agriculture prevents everybody. Everybody here looks like they're well-fed. They got clothes. They got shoes, all from agriculture. And it helps every kind of, almost every business in California helps the restaurants, the schools, the stores, the packing houses, shipping, stuff and all. It has all kinds, a little bit of money that the farmers get is more than quadruple, goes out all over the world. I was going to say, you mentioned something about the Delta smelt. And you know, we've been studying the Delta smelt, and maybe we're wrong, but we figure that the bass eat a big portion, maybe not 90%, but at least 70% or maybe up to 90% of the Delta smelt. Is that right? And then you blame agriculture because they don't have enough water to flow for the, and they don't know for sure if the extra water is going to help the smelt anyway. So what's your comment on that Delta smelt?
Well, the priority as stated is you know, if a project can improve outflow at key seasons, key times of the year, to benefit either our pelagic fishes like delta smelt, lungfin smelt, or other anadromous fishes for providing those cues for upstream migration, that those are priorities of the department. So it's, you know, while those species would be beneficiaries of delta outflow, it's really delta outflow as a, you know, it provides multiple ecosystem benefits at the very base of the food web all the way up to the consumers in the food chain.
I disagree. But
so it's improving the general overall ecosystem condition of the lower estuary.
So we want to make sure we give everybody a chance one at a time, and I think there's a couple waiting
in
line again.
I got several things since I...
There was a gentleman who went back in line for his second question. Sorry. Yes. We want to make sure everybody has a chance to cycle through.
Well, I'd like to make a statement. The presentation you gave, Scott, is extremely encouraging, and I fully support it. And we've come a long way from 50 or 100 years ago to take these under consideration. So I praise your actions and your presentation. My question has to do with groundwater cleanup. Prop 1, groundwater sustainability under what the state board, $900 million for groundwater cleanup. But you mentioned groundwater cleanup here, and it's how does groundwater cleanup fit in to the 2.7 CWC work?
Jenny or Commissioner Quintero?
Well, that would make it an eligible project. You know, so they, along with it being an eligible project, it would also have to have these other benefits. So it wouldn't be just the cleanup. And, I mean, we really are just beginning. I work at a university. I'm the executive director of a research institute that focuses on water in the state of California and primarily in the San Joaquin Valley. And we are just really beginning to understand how groundwater systems work. And we have a tremendous amount of work ahead of us. And, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of experimentation going on right now on methods of recharging those basins and also of understanding what happens when you draw down an aquifer and then recharge it. There, you know, you're a hydrologist, you know that there's a lot of geochemistry involved. And so we, along with looking ahead at quantities of water, we're going to have to be looking at water quality because that can be affected when you draw down an aquifer and then recharge it. And so what we're looking at right now, I think, with Prop 1, Chapter 8, benefits, is looking at who can get those systems working conjunctively. So we take surface projects and connect them to groundwater, recharge, and I'll just say that we want to get those projects going. It's time to do it.
So groundwater cleanup wouldn't be a standalone project, because I'm trying to think about how you get an ecosystem of 50% improvement with groundwater cleanup. I understand improvement, but ecosystem improvement with groundwater cleanup.
I think there's some options there. Of course, they're going to have to be I clearly described in the project description of the project, but you know, it says in the statute that groundwater contamination prevention and remediation projects are eligible project types if they provide storage benefits. So you've got to tie the cleanup to some sort of storage project. So if by cleaning up a basin, it allows you to utilize that basin for storage, or you know, there's ways to tell the story to become an eligible project, but to get those ecosystem benefits, I think, you know, there's a lot of opportunity there, because you know, there could be wetlands above the basin, or there could be a groundwater surface water interaction or connection that someone could make a tie to a fisheries benefit. But it's definitely that's not an easy one. And someone's going to have to do a lot of work and be able to provide justification, documentation, and modeling and analysis that supports how this groundwater cleanup project provides ecosystem benefits.
Very good. Thank you. Very clear answers by all. I appreciate it.
Yes. And then show of hands, are there any other comments while he's making his way up? Questions or comments waiting? Okay, we'll go over here and then this, sir.
I'll just add a bit to the groundwater cleanup in the specific project. Say the oil industry, they produce...
Up to the mic.
They produce 15 gallons of water per gallon of oil produced, but it's polluted. It comes back to production water. We can separate that and put it into the ground. And what it sounds like is whatever we clean up, we have to bioremediate. So we do have some kind of place where, you know, birds and animals can hang out. What was my question? I'm sorry, I forgot. It's been a long day. It's been very hot in the car driving all over the state. Oh, I know now because I've been driving all over the state. Indirect land use. Salton Sea is dying. Okay. It's a major bird habitat flow to the Delta. Say there's the quantification act to give San Diego water. If through geothermal we can produce water that can surface, that can feed the sea, that will keep the birds there, are we indirectly affecting the Delta? Or are we directly affecting the wildlife of the Delta? And is the Salton Sea and what we're doing eligible for funding?
Early in 2016, we're going to be requesting concept papers for various projects where the commission can get a little more detail on potential projects and support and eligibility determination. You know, based on the example, I can't say if it's eligible or not. I can only say that, the project needs to tell the story about how it directly or indirectly provides ecosystem improvements to the Delta or tributaries to the Delta. Mm-hmm. So if there are indirect mechanisms where there are commitments in place that through certain activities, if it's demand reduction or whatever it might be, mm-hmm. that would go to supporting ecosystem improvements in the Delta or TRIBs, that would definitely be a doorway for eligibility, but without seeing kind of a concept paper, more information, I'm not going to say if it's, yes, that's eligible. But
we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
We all do. Thank you.
Yeah. Ma'am, you had a question. I want to make sure we get as many people. Do you? Comments are fine as well. Sure, the mic gets you.
Okay.
Perfect.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm Linda Sullivan. I live in Antioch. And I have been for the past 7 years just as an individual humbly studying water situations in California. And what I am seeing is that it is really important. I'm looking at all of the situations you've set up, and and please excuse, I'm not very public speaker, but within all of this wordage, it's really important that we take some of the science that is coming forth, especially about groundwater storage, that we don't know. They're not quick fixes. We don't know that they, we know about reservoirs. We know what we've done in this state. And so I'm urging the thoughts to give absolute time for the public to understand how the advantages of groundwater storage and the multitudes of possibilities out there, that the general public understands that, rather than some of the hard hitters coming in with talking about investment and the large water suppliers deciding how they're going to get their water. I mean, this is what is essentially important for the future of people, actually throughout the world, that we do things differently.
I have a couple comments. I think this is a really good analogy when you think about water in California. Imagine that you have two checkbooks and you have two checking accounts. One checkbook is for your surface water storage. You know how many acre feet is in your surface water. And so you can write checks and you can manage that surface water pretty accurately, and you can consider water rights and all of that. When it comes to groundwater, imagine if you had a checking account where you never knew the balance, but you had a checkbook. What's that?
So I can get out.
Yeah. And that's what we're doing with groundwater in the state. And historically, groundwater has really acted as a reserve during drought. Here we are in our fourth year of drought. We don't know how long this is going to last. And we're actually using our reserves so fast right now that there are areas that are where you're losing the groundwater storage permanently because the ground is sinking. And so one of the things that we have to do is we as a state, we have to look at all of these resources together and manage them really, it's funny, sustainable is a funny word, because one of my friends who's a science fiction writer said, you know, when people hear sustainable, they think, I want to feel good about what I'm doing and not have a negative effect. And what he prefers to use is the term permaculture. So how can we manage a system and imagine that it will work the same way and efficiently 100 years from now? And it's going to take us time to learn how to do this. And so we really need to come together. This Chapter 8 Prop 1 money is just a small piece of how we look ahead to the future and how we look at water quality and water quantity. And again, right now we are using our reserves without knowing what's going to happen in the future. And so my wife, who is in private banking, I was talking to her about this one time, and she said, wow, she goes, it's like somebody has a checkbook and they're saying, what do you mean I don't have any money? I have a checkbook. You know, and so really, I think we really have to pull together on this. And it really, sir, is about agriculture. It is about communities. And it is about the environment of the state where we live. And, I mean, one of the big impacts that you're all aware of are, communities at risk that really have no water at all. So there are a lot of groups that are being affected by this. And the commission certainly is interested in making sure that we work with all of our partners in making the most effective use of these dollars possible.
Well, 48% of our water is government eco water, 48%. And it was said something about the North Coast. North Coast rivers, starting with the Russian River, west of the Coast Ranges, we don't have one dam. Russian River, Navarro River, Garcia River, Eel River, pardon me?
Sir, gentlemen, we...
What's here in California that we can get.
Gentlemen, we have to stay on the mic, and we only have about 10 minutes
left.
Well,
you had took a lot of time with the presenter, so we should have that much some time. But we have the Navarro River, the Garcia River, the Gualla River, Eel River, Russian River, Mad River, Van Dusen River, Klamath River, and the Smith River, not one dam. And this last year, we had estimated 7 trillion gallons of water flowed right into the ocean. And if you divide that 7 trillion gallons by the 38 million people here in California, that's 170,000 gallons for every man, woman, and child in 1 year. And so people don't have any idea what's going on with our water. And you can check, of course, I've got my almanacs, I have all the figures, but you can check those figures that I said. Now, I was going to ask you, can the fish and wildlife, state fish and wildlife, they already have a budget, will they get extra money from this? Above their budget? If you make a project, or is that project, are you going to take money from this project and fund the employees of the Fish and Wildlife? Is that legal? You understand what I said?
Yeah, to my knowledge, the department is not going to be making any proposals for...
So you don't make them, it's other people.
No, we're not going to be sponsoring any...
Okay, I got a whole night proposals. To talk that I won't let... Oh, I've been living 85 years in Richmond and El Cerrito, and the bay water hasn't risen one inch. This stuff that human beings only live on 2% of the earth. And there's no way you can make as much trouble as possible. There's no way you can pollute the earth. And no way human activity can change the earth. Only the sun changes the earth. And our water hasn't risen one bit in 85 years. But of course the papers will tell you different. Thank you.
Thank you. Show of hands, we have about 5 to 10 minutes. How many more comments, questions do we have? Comments or questions? All right, while you're thinking about that, we just want to let you guys know that there's some additional opportunities. I will see if there's any more questions, but do you want to go over this very quickly?
Well, before I go over the next way in which you can participate, I want to thank you for participating today and hanging in there until the very last minute. We appreciate you coming out and spending your evening here. We know it's not, you know, your first choice of how to spend your Monday evening, but we certainly appreciate it, especially those of you that had a holiday today. But for future engagement, again, this is not the last stop on the train for your participation. We've had 7 advisory committee meetings, but we just had our last meeting the first week in October, so we are no longer meeting with our stakeholder advisory committee. But we do have 2 more public meetings in October. We'll be in Clovis on Wednesday and then Yuba City the following Wednesday if you want to join us again. Again, you have the regulations in your package. If you'd like to provide comments, the next slide has a email address that you can provide some comments to, but those would be informal comments. And if you'd like to wait until the commission starts its 45-day public comment period, those would be formal comments, and the commission and commission staff would write a response to all of those comments received then. We also have a commission listserv, so if you'd like to join our email list, when you signed in today, that was to join the list, not to sign in for the meeting, but you are now a part of our listserv. Everything that you see during a public meeting or commission meeting is posted on the commission's website, so it's a great resource. If you go to all the meeting links, all the materials that have been previously provided are linked on that site. As I mentioned before, in early 2016, we're going to do a survey for concept papers. So if you are a project proponent, start thinking about how your project might operate, where is it at, where is it getting its water from, what are potential public benefits. This isn't going to be a detailed, it's a concept paper, so just a qualitative description over a couple of pages at most. It will not be a heavy lift for folks, and it is not required, but it helps us formulate our process and our program a little bit better and helps you to have some interaction with us to identify potential eligibility issues or flaws. Again, we're going to do some workshops for the applicants. So as the regulation makes its way through the formal rulemaking process, we're going to be working on the application instructions and technical guidance documents. So when we're getting those in draft form, we're going to start doing some workshops and outreach on the instructions and the technical guidance. And lastly, commission meetings. Every commission meeting is available to the public and website and webcast. And they are always the third Wednesday of every month. They're going to continue to meet throughout this process every month, and we encourage you to participate. There is opportunity for public comment after every agenda item, and the water storage investment program is discussed at every meeting. Normally, if it's not a half day, it's a day and a half where we just talk about the water storage investment program. So we encourage you to participate there. And I'll put in one last plug. These aren't the only places you should be participating. We've said today over and over we're a cost-share partner. The commission is a cost-share partner. There's other folks involved. So project proponents are going to be formulating their projects. In most cases, it's going to be those public agencies, those water suppliers. So attend their board meetings. Work closely with them to ensure that your concerns are being met and the projects are formulated to achieve the objectives that you locally have. So not only participate in our process, but participate on the local end as well. So again, thank you very much. Commissioner, do you have any closing comments?
As I said when I welcomed you, your comments are critically important to all of us. We take everything, like I said earlier, to heart and to mind. And to repeat what Jenny said, thanks for spending your Monday evening with us. And thanks again.
All right. Again, if you think of anything after or if you've reviewed the draft regulations, here's the comment address. And don't forget to pick up your useful links card. Not only does this tell you how to connect with the Water Commission, the calendars, it also has that email address for additional comments and questions. Thank you all, everyone, for joining us this evening. Safe travels. Don't forget to take some water to drink on the way.